Albert Tai is the founder and CEO of Hypercare, a VC-backed healthcare technology company that helps connect the right healthcare providers at the right time to improve patient outcomes. Albert started Hypercare in 2016 when he realized how challenging it was to communicate efficiently in the healthcare space. He hasn't looked back since then, and Hypercare has launched in over 100 organizations across North America, from large hospital systems to small community health centers. I had a lot of fun chatting with Albert about his upbringing that saw him move from Canada to Taiwan and back, how he convinced his parents to work in tech, and what advice he has to those trying to figure out what to do with their career. Hope you enjoy this episode, and let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome to Asian Tech Leaders, the podcast where we interview some of the most interesting and inspiring Asian CEOs, entrepreneurs, and thinkers. I'm your host, Justin Pang, and I'm on a mission to share the stories of Asian tech leaders to help guide your personal and professional life. Thanks so much for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, Albert.
Hello, Justin.
Happy Monday. It is Monday, November the 20th. There's a very eventful weekend in tech and AI this weekend with the OpenAI news. And without going into our armchair analysis of what happened and why and all the ins and outs of it, wanted to kind of start with, you know, where you're at as a CEO and founder of your company. What have been some of your key takeaways from what has ensued the last couple of days with OpenAI?
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, following the news is not too much information. It's very limited in terms of what has been released. There's a lot of, you know, questions about what happened. But I think some of the key takeaways as, you know, a leader in the company is around making sure like you have full control of the company. You know, it's so important. The way you've structured made it easy to be kicked out. And I think it's one of the things I see sometimes with my friends' companies, if they raise a lot of venture capital, they give a lot of board seats away. And sometimes investors will replace the CEO just because it doesn't fit the vision that they want to see too. So it's so important to align your vision with the board, but also making sure the board members are people you really believe in where you want to head to. And control is obviously very, very important. I think another thing is also shown that by having really good fit with your team and building a good culture, there's a way to potentially come back. Sam obviously has built a team where they really believe the vision that he has is really vital and people are willing to leave when he's gone, which made the board rethink the decision to let him go. So I think those are kind of things that are big learnings around that. But certainly it's an interesting time for sure. And I guess the biggest investor too, I guess Microsoft, making sure the biggest investor is on your corner. That's also important.
Right. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. It's like reality TV playing in your eyes, right? Yeah. It's been fascinating to follow and interesting to hear your takeaways, and the news is still unfolding real time.
So yeah.
See where it ends up. But really excited to have you on the podcast and hear a little bit more about your story, what you've been building at Hypercare, and also kind of your plans for the company and the organization going forward. But kind of want to start with your origin story. So if you could share a little bit more about your upbringing and early childhood, we'd love to start there.
Yeah. So my family is, we like to kind of joke about it, like we're like basically gypsies. We moved around a lot. So I was born in Taiwan. And my family moved really early on, like when I was like 3, to Detroit. And my dad was doing a master's back then. So he was kind of trying to finish up his master's in Detroit. And then we kind of lived in Windsor, which is right across Detroit. And we then moved from Vancouver. So we moved around a lot, just even within Windsor and Detroit, and also even Vancouver. But I was able to kind of have a childhood that was, I guess, learn how to speak English really early. I was a little bit nervous about like going to washroom, but you know, just kind of like having childhood that was pretty much like growing up mostly in Canada, but it was also kind of somewhat difficult because we moved around a lot, which means like new schools, trying to learn how to make new friends, you know, pretty quickly. Fundamentally, my dad at some point came back to do his PhD in Detroit at the same school. Mm-hmm. So I came back to Windsor again. from Vancouver in about grade six. But I, at some point in my childhood, I actually moved back to Taiwan for grade four and five. And that was quite a culture shock. You know, when you think about it, you grew up mostly in Canada and you go back and there was a different dynamics, but it was definitely interesting as well.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's obviously a lot of change, right? And probably really good training grounds for you being in tech and running the company of just being very adaptable and finding ways to kind of cut through some of the noise and also just work with a lot of different people and situations.
Yeah, and learning how to build relationships really quickly because you're moving around a lot. It's like kind of like networking every year at least.
right. And I mean, I had a similar childhood because my parents moved us quite a lot as well to Vancouver and even within Toronto to different schools and different neighborhoods. And I think back of like, wow, it was hard to actually build deep friendships, right? Because we were moving around a lot. But now that I'm an adult, I'm the one at, you know, my kids' school when I drop them off or pick them up, chit-chatting with the other parents. And part of that had to do with, again, the adaptability. So going back to Taiwan, how much of a kind of reverse culture shock was that? Was it, did you find it pretty easy to adapt kind of back to your original birthplace, or had you already been quite Canadianized or Westernized at that point that you didn't know how you fit in?
Yeah, I mean the food was great. That wasn't a difficult like change. We're eating pretty Asian food at home already too. So that was like a really nice, like, you know, homey feel. But I would say, like, in terms of school and in terms of like just overall the culture, it was definitely a huge shock. Like a good example is even like schooling. So schooling is very different. There's a lot of route memorization, and I was not a big fan of that. I feel like I really like the Western culture of like learning why something you're supposed to know, some sort of knowledge. But there was a lot of like memorization. I think one of the ones I can remember is like, they try to memorize passages from Confucius, for example, and you have to actually repeat it. And just, it was quite not the way I learn. And it made me like kind of very heavily resistant of like route memorization in general, all the way to university. And then I think the second thing that was very interesting too is like, they're definitely a little bit harsher. And I can remember I went back and for the first year I did like public school. So I just actually, I didn't do private school, like where it's bilingual. I just did private public school, which is actually like what everyone goes to. And my Chinese was terrible in terms of writing and reading. And there was a test where you kind of have to like write all these words. And I remember after the test, I got negative 80%. And the reason why I can get negative 80% is if you guess and you get it wrong, you get negative marks. If you leave it blank, it's zero. And if you get it right, it's plus one. Wow. So it's just kind of like, you know, obviously it's a different dynamic, right? It's like, it almost makes you not want to guess and try to, you know, and characters are so hard. There's like 50 different like little things in there and just need one to be wrong and you get a negative one. So it was a different dynamic. And then I guess another thing that was a different thing that was hard to wrap my head around is I guess the teacher punishing students when they're not like, you know, focused in class or they're talking a lot. You know, in Canada it's a little bit different. They'll talk to you about it, they'll like warn you about it. In Taiwan they have little fake hands. It's like a plastic hand, very small, and they'll hit you. It's almost like a ruler, just hit you, your hand. Nothing crazy, but it's still something like I'm like shocked. I'm like, wow, like this teacher is punishing me physically on something that, like, you know. And so definitely a little bit different from a dynamic of Canada where that is not okay.
Right. But you definitely remember those moments and whatever you did right or wrong, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. I remember those moments, you know, for sure.
Yeah. Even doing Taekwondo in Toronto, I remember, you know, doing my maybe yellow belt. And if you're not sitting and meditating properly, the master would walk around the studio and have a little wooden stick. And if he didn't think you were sitting in the right posture, he would give you a knock on the head. It's like a gentle tap, but it's still from a grown man to a child. It hurt.
Yeah, exactly. We'll and then you're like, wow, that's possible. Yeah.
So. Won't forget that. And I wonder if that still happens in 2023.
Probably. Yeah, I don't know. I do wonder. Like, I don't have like super strong family ties with my family members in Taiwan because I don't go back too much. So I don't know if like this still happens. But yes, I would be very interested. Like it was just little things like, for example, they make you do squats. So if you like get in trouble, they make you do squats by the wall and you sit in the squat position for like maybe like, you know, 5 minutes or a few minutes. And it's like, you know, exercise basically, but it's a way to punish you. And I would never imagine that to be happening in Canada. So it's just like something that would only happen in Asia, you know?
Great memory, Nick. Exactly. Well, you won't forget it for sure. No. And then growing up, what sparked your curiosity? What were you really interested in? And some of the constants despite moving around quite a bit in your childhood?
Yeah, I mean, sparking curiosity. I really always liked technology. I always really, my dad had a laptop really early on because he was going through master's. So it was very unique that, you know, I want to say like maybe 20 years ago or so, he had one of the first laptops, you know, like it was probably somewhere it's like 1 megabyte for hard drive, like something super, super small. I still remember it was an Acer laptop, had a floppy disk, had all the stuff. So it was really cool to be exposed to technology really, really early on. Going back to Taiwan when I was grade 4 and grade 5, there was a lot of technology expos. I went to a lot of them. Like one of the largest computer expos is hosted in Taiwan. And so I really enjoyed going there and seeing a ton of technology that's coming out. I got lucky. I came back to Canada in grade 6, and I also got my first laptop myself too. My parents got it for me, so I was able to be exposed to actually my own personal laptop, which is also, I would say, fairly rare back then. So just exposed to computers really, really early on. When I was in Taiwan, my parents enrolled me to basically what people call coding boot camps now. But I guess before it was cool. So I learned how to program in Java and Visual Basic 6.0 when I was like about 11. And that spurred me to like create a bunch of software, create a bunch of websites to promote those software. Got myself into like this whole of like, you know, SEO, PageRank and all this stuff. So it was like a really nice opening for, I guess, how I was developed in terms of curiosity. Yeah.
Wow. So what were some of the programs that you developed?
So I remember one
focus or something else. Sorry.
No, something else. So I think one of the first ones I was developing was something around, it's like back then now, I'm trying to remember, but it was something around like detecting people with motion cameras. Like if you're in front of a camera and someone moves. The thing is, I didn't write everything from scratch. It was like back then there was open source already. That was a concept. Mm-hmm. So you can actually go there, download open source code. And what I did was I download open source code, I modified heavily, and then I made it for free. And once you make it for free, you have to like find all the places to distribute your software. So back then, 2Cows was huge. So I would like apply to be on 2Cows, have my software there. And I think one of the things that made me really like Visual Basic, so most of my coding was in Visual Basic 6.0, was really similar to what I like about, I guess, Android development and Apple development, which is like the combination of drag and dropping user interface components. Mm-hmm. And then tying that to code is one of the few places where you're like, I don't have to write a lot. And then my screens and my windows are pretty. You drag and drop buttons, components. So that was really nice. And that got me into website development, where I built a bunch of websites, various different kinds, and sold ads on them, sold some of them as property, and funded some of my hobbies as a kid.
Wow. So this is during high school that you start, or even middle school, right, that you started developing software and making some money off of it.
Yeah. And then I remember like when I was, I'm not sure if I was 11 or maybe 12, one of my first requests for my parents as a gift for Christmas. I usually don't really ask for a particular thing. Mm-hmm. Actually, maybe not true. I probably asked for some things, but I do remember this thing because I asked my parents for a domain name when I was like 11 or 12. And my parents like, no, focus on school. So I got that rejected. So I had to hustle my way. It was a hosting company in Turkey where I convinced them to buy me a domain, let me host some servers, and basically build up like my first website, which was back then it was called tysoft.org, and that's where all my software was and everything. Yeah.
Very cool. Do you still have the domain today?
No, it's a complicated story, but essentially, eventually I got the page rank high enough and they essentially took over my property and tried to sell it back to me. So no, it was an unfortunate story, but because of the money I generated from that website property, I was able to like start other website properties with that money. But I know it was an unfortunate reality. Like
your early lesson, right? In your startup.
Oh yeah, early lesson. I should have had a contract. That's one thing I learned.
And then share a little bit more about, you know, your parents' kind of support or what they were looking to nudge you towards, right, as you were growing up. I know you mentioned they weren't necessarily overly supportive of you going into a career or studying in tech or software development. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, my dad was doing a master's in information technology in Detroit. And I think my parents felt, and Valley back then, it was like the, you know, dot-com boom and everything. So it's kind of still fresh, but they felt like there wasn't a lot of like job prospects in technology. And, you know, it's a little bit of a high pressure, you know, industry. There's a lot of like catch up you got to do. So they felt like, you know, one of the most stable industries, and this is why a lot of immigrant parents push their children to go into it, is being a doctor. Being a doctor, being a dentist, like going to healthcare, or being a pharmacist. So my parents really wanted me to go to that direction. And that's one of the reasons why during high school, they didn't really want me to program or even participate in programming classes, which is like very unfortunate because like they're the ones who got me into the hobby, but totally understandable. They want me to have a better life than they have in Canada. And, you know, for them, which makes sense, you know, you can't go wrong being a doctor or being a nurse or being a pharmacist. Like it's a very stable job. And there's always going to be a demand. You're not going to get laid off really. So that's one of the directions that they wanted me to go into. And that's why I ended up choosing and starting my undergrad in medical science, trying to go into the path that they kind of, you know, heavily influenced me to.
Oh, so that was a compromise of like, okay, you actually started in medical science and then later added computer science as a second degree, or did you actually transition out of?
So that was funny because like that was essentially after some time they saw that I wasn't giving up on my hobbies of like building website domains and software, and so eventually they're like, you know what, if you're really really passionate about it, you can continue doing this. And it's been like, you know, by the time it was so I switched in the end of second year, I believe. By that time it has been what, more than a decade of seeing me like just continuously programming, continuously making like website development. So they're like, okay, if you really want to go into it, you've shown me that you've done this for 10 years, you have to graduate on time. So because I have to graduate on time, I actually didn't do another degree. I just switched my concentration from like medical science to a double major to medical science, computer science. And thankfully I went to Western. I'm not sure if they will let people get away with this anymore, but I was able to do first year, second year, and third year classes in some of the semesters. I just had a bunch of exceptions. I got a bunch of exceptions. Oh, wow. I feel like this is not something you can do in Waterloo. Like they would definitely not let you pull it off. But just like I remember my first semester of undergrad. First semester after I switched to double major, my computer science courses was kind of everywhere. Like I had first, second year, third year with like, you know, mandatory requirements I'm taking the same semester, which is quite hard, I would say. But it was definitely worth it. I graduated on time and I was able to like, you know, switch into double major. Yeah.
And then even throughout this process, as you're aiming to graduate on time, did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do post graduation in terms of work, starting your own company, working for a tech company? Where was your head at the time?
Yeah, it's funny because like I would say throughout like high school and undergrad, I started a bunch of like, I would say, I don't want to say startups because it wasn't focused on like building profits, but certainly like I sold website properties, some of them I sold for like 1.5K or 2 grand, which is like a lot for like as a kid. And a lot of them I would like hire people to like kind of help with some of the development work or design work or something like that. So I was starting to like kind of get into almost like product management like understanding what we need to build, why you're building it. And then some of them I would charge money, but it wasn't like anything sophisticated. So I always thought like I would go into creating my own software company. But certainly after like that switch, I'm just like happy I was able to go into computer science. So fourth year, so first year, second year, third year, all my summers, I was working at summer camp and I loved it. And fourth year was my first time I interned at like a tech company. And I got really lucky for someone who went to Western, which is unfortunately not the best computer science school in Canada. I was one of the two people that got chosen by Microsoft to be like an intern there. And so I did product management at Microsoft as an intern, which they call program management. I mean, after that, I honestly thought at one point I was just going to just work at Microsoft. It was a very chill culture. Certainly it was very fascinating to see so many people who worked there for a very long time, who has a lot of experience and knowledge. So certainly it was like one of the directions I was like, huh, maybe this is a cool way. Yeah.
But you didn't end up working there after the internship, right? So what happened or what opportunities?
Yeah. So it's very interesting. There's a lot of learnings, I would say. So at big tech companies, halfway through, you have a midpoint check-in. And usually at the midpoint check-in, you know if you're going to get a return offer or not based on like the midpoint review. So I had a glowing midpoint review. I was like, oh, I'm going to get a return offer. I started looking at apartments and everything. And I think this is one of the learnings I had and it still stuck with me, was like knowing how to navigate feedback and how to work in a big team, especially if it's like a little bit of, you know, there's like a little bit of politics. I remember there was like one, my project touched, unfortunately, a bunch of teams at Microsoft. I was responsible for Windows licensing, and it was at a time where like Microsoft was moving a lot of licensing to the Microsoft Store. So my team was not in charge of the full scope of licensing anymore. I had to work with other teams. And essentially there was like a kind of debate between me and my colleague around how we want to navigate. Like, you know, traditionally my team was writing very long product specifications, and that team was very used to dealing with very short product specifications, letting the engineers kind of run with how they want to build it. You know, as an intern who spent basically the entire summer with this feature, and I wrote up like a 30-page product spec, I'm like, I don't understand. Just take my product spec. Like, I thought about everything. And, you know, I think a lot of that learning is like meeting people where they're at. I should have just like distill it down, give it to them. But fundamentally, that disagreement that happened really close to my finishing of my internship is like 2 weeks before, that kind of like jeopardized my return offer. I didn't get it. And in hindsight, 2020 is like, oh, I'm so happy. But no, at that point in time, I was like super bummed. I was like, I can't believe it. Like, I had a great midpoint review. I was doing a lot of networking too with like, you know, partners and directors at Microsoft, because I was trying to actually think about a new teams as well, because licensing was there for a long time. So it wasn't as, I would say, like this limited stuff that you can be creative with. So I was just kind of trying to think about different teams. I was not even expecting not to get a return offer. So it was definitely like an eye-opening experience, like making sure you know how to navigate organizational dynamics, which honestly kind of helps with the healthcare aspect, where every single hospital is very large and complicated. So that got me to my master's, because my dad was like, if you don't get a return offer, don't look for another job, just get your master's. And I totally get where he's coming from. Just kind of like finish your school that you want to do. So then when you start a family, you're not trying to balance between school and family. That's what he did when he did his master's and PhD. So I did follow his advice. And then that's where Hypercare was born out of. So I never went back to a big tech company.
Oh, wow. So how long was the master's program that you did at U of T?
It was 2 years. It was a master of information. Basically learning how to do architecture diagrams, thinking about how different information technology kind of fits well with each other. Yeah. A lot of people that came out would be like, you know, business analysts or enterprise architecture, kind of thinking about like business flows and process optimizations and stuff like that. So it fundamentally was like helpful actually in thinking about Hypercare, where there's a lot of complexities around different softwares and different people and stakeholders and whatever. But that's how like Hypercare came out. Halfway through my master's, I started the company.
What was the insight or the hypothesis or thread that you were pulling on early on in the hypercare days of, oh, I need to look into this. And then as you dug a little bit deeper, you realize a software solution could solve the problem.
Yeah. So I got lucky. Halfway through my master's, I wanted to take things outside my like my master degree. So I took like two MBA courses and I took two computer science courses. And the MBA stuff, I focused on the ones I don't really understand, like marketing, for example, or healthcare innovation. And then the computer science courses, I took two computer science courses in U of T. One of them is called Topics in Computer Science, and one of them is called Business of Software. So the two courses, if you take it jointly together, is essentially you learn how to build a software company, which is awesome. And then you also actually build the actual product that the software company is. So it just happened to be that that year the theme was healthcare innovation. And so we had a professor that was extremely keen. We got a bunch of doctors and I believe in even nurses as mentors. We had three doctors as mentors. And all of them are in different places and different specialties. And one of them was a department head of internal medicine. One of them was a general surgery resident. And one of them was a neurosurgery resident. So they all have different perspectives. But fundamentally, they communicated how difficult it was to coordinate care in healthcare, especially around just connecting with each other. And I was like, why don't you just use WhatsApp? And they're like, yeah, we do use WhatsApp. It's not compliant. But we also use something called a pager, and the rest of the hospital will page me. And between my small surgical team, I might WhatsApp each other, even though I know it's not compliant. It's the best thing that we have, actually. And so that opened my eyes because I've never seen a pager in my life still. And I'm like, how does a pager work? Can you explain to me? And they're like, well, someone calls a number and you get a callback number, and then you find a phone and you call them back. And I'm like, oh, why do you guys do that? And they're like, just that's the thing. Legacy tech. And then that should have given me a hint of how difficult it is to change healthcare, but instead my naiveness was like, oh, that's great, that's easy to solve with the software, you know, it's compliant, WhatsApp for healthcare stored in Canada. How hard could it be? And obviously healthcare is hard because you can tell that the legacy tech and navigating, you know, environments and political and risk aversion was honestly the biggest challenge, which is almost like distribution. Not only having a perfect product, but like having compliance sorted out and then distributing your product is very, very difficult in healthcare.
Wow. So at what point did you actually make the leap and say, okay, I'm going to dedicate my time full time into this? Was that pretty clear midway through your master's of like, there's something here, I'm going to do this after I graduate? Or did that decision happen a little bit later?
Yeah. So like during the course, we were the only project that incorporated, because I was talking to my team. Oh, okay. It was like in February. So the course started in January. And like after 1 month, I'm like, guys, this is really cool. I think we get to make a huge impact for providers that like work super hard. And I got really passionate because the surgical resident that like had us like shadow him, he's amazing. He showed me that like how hard it is to be a doctor. He was working like 30-hour call shifts. We actually slept in an on-call room and everything felt like paper. And just like, it was almost like, in a way, I guess, really bad working environment. And on top of like, you know, the long hours, the stressful environment, they're also dealing with like the worst tools out there. So I was like, if I can make a difference, that'll be huge. Like the smartest people, we're helping the smartest people, you know, do work better. Mm-hmm. So I was like, hey guys, like, why don't we make this into a company? And these people, I don't know at all. It was just like a project. It was a course. So I'm like, hey, let's make a company. And my team was like, yeah, sure, let's try it for the summer. And so I got my team, we incorporated during the project. I think I paid for it and I split it across the people. And then summer hit and kind of, you know, things kind of started falling apart. One person had a PhD they got, so they kind of left. Another person was still working full time at another company. So it was just hard to like try to run at full speed when someone's like has another full-time job. So that didn't work out. And then there was only one person that kind of stuck with us for a very long time. And he was just like, who's there, and kind of moving things forward. So it was just me and this guy called Jason. And we did most of the kind of like the first year of work. And yeah, it was quite difficult, I would say, because, you know, obviously you're expecting like to have more resources and more people, but it's a balance. It's like you try and move fast and whatever. So during the first year, it was a lot of like trying to figure out how to sustain yourself. I was still doing masters. Thankfully, my master's wasn't too stressful, but just kind of keeping yourself afloat. So line of credit, you know, working part-time jobs, keep money.
So you're bootstrapping it from the beginning.
Yeah. There was a lot of just trying to get money. Like, I think the big breakthrough was like, we got this government grant by OCI, which is Ontario Centers of Innovation, for like 37K. And then we're like, we had our first injection of capital. We were able to like spend more money, hire more people. But yeah, it was quite rough until, you know, 2 years later. It was about 2 years later that we raised our first round of funding. So I know a lot of my friends, like they started a company, raised capital right away, but we were not in a fortune to do so. We took like 2 years to actually raise our first round of capital. And that's also roughly when we got our first client. So our first revenue, basically. Oh,
well, your first paying customer happened 2 years in. Share a little bit more about that and like even who you are selling to, right? Because you mentioned kind of the complexity of selling into healthcare, Canadian compliance and regulations. Can you share a little bit more color into that, like the first win and how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, like looking back at it, it's very unfortunate because I feel like we lost like 2 or 3 years in the beginning, just kind of learning how to navigate healthcare. That could have been spent moving faster, but it's all life lessons. In the beginning, there's a few mistakes I made. We're trying to go after too large of a hospital. We had a lot of connections through like one of our mentors who was like the department head of a huge hospital in Toronto. So we were trying to work through that. You know, I think the problem is sometimes Canadians are really, really nice. It's hard to know if it's a yes, no. Yes or no. A lot of people say maybe. Yeah. So one of the big healthcare systems, we actually had a few department heads interested. We actually had executive vice president of technology that reports directly to CEO interested. But you know, the thing that I should have questioned is how much was actually getting moved, how much stuff was happening. And because of complexity of healthcare, deploying anything is really, really long and arduous. And so given that people are really, really busy, they're burnt out, if it's not top three priority, it's probably not going to get done. So there's certain movements of it, like that makes you feel like hopeful, but it wasn't like, oh, everything is happening all the time, all the time. And unfortunately, momentum is really, really hard to start and really easy to lose. And so looking back at it, it's very, you know, one of the biggest learnings now is making sure you have a healthy pipeline. You don't have one opportunity in your pipeline. You have a lot of opportunities in your pipeline. And that way you can focus your energy on the opportunities that are moving fast, but also keep the opportunities that are like maybe just a little bit slower and keeping them on the loop and making sure you can help them build a business case. And the ones that you feel like it's not moving at all, you kill it. So it's certainly an engineer who never built and never sold a software. It was not something I knew. So just kind of like the hope of like, oh, it's going to move. And at some point it didn't move. And then we got lucky. One of our first customers, there was like a few customers that were very early on. One of them came just from finding us on Google, secure messaging for healthcare. And they found us through that. And we got our first like basic department of a hospital. And our first hospital was this doctor I was supposed to meet. He was a product manager at Microsoft too. And after 10 years as in tech, he decided to quit and become a doctor. And so I was supposed to meet up with him. And then we got connected through the mentor we had who's a department head. And we just never met. And then after some time, he actually cold emailed us and said, hey, Albert, like we're looking for a solution for our hospital to reduce burnout by helping doctors connect easier. And that was our first hospital. It wasn't as easy as that. We had to compete with two other solutions because everything's public money. So we had to beat other solutions, but choosing. RFQ in this case. It was RFQ. So yeah, and that was our first hospital. So that was like the journey that we finally started getting momentum. Yeah.
Wow, congrats. And you know, having talked to a lot of startup founders, CEOs, you really need a lot of optimism and positivity to get you through some of the tough times, which can inevitably happen, right? There'll be the of disillusion and there are tough times. what keeps you motivated, right? Whenever things get tough, is there something that has been persistent to just keep you focused and going? Because I think you've been working on hypercare for 7-8 years.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So certainly, it's around. I would say the biggest thing for sure is definitely the impact. So mm-hmm. I remember early on, before no one used hypercare. Every time I had a really bad meeting where I'm like, oh, I thought this was going to happen, but it didn't happen. I remember when I used to live downtown, I would go to one of the downtown hospitals and just chat with clinicians. And people would be like, yeah, this pager workflow is such a big pain point. I hate it. And those are kind of things that fuel, because you kind of have to be reminded, why am I spending so much time? Why am I, losing a bit of my life going through this very difficult industry? It's ultimately solving problems for people you really care about. And so I think those are kind of things that make you very motivated when there's days where you can see there's so much red tape. There's going to be a big journey to get this hospital work with us, and that other aspect really kind of shift your mindset. Nowadays, unfortunately, I don't see all the impact that we can make, but sometimes I get to be participating part of it in terms of stories that people tell me. Recently, one of our staff was sick, so I was stepping in for her. And I was part of a deployment where there was an older physician, and he's actually also a dentist. And he was going around teaching everyone about the application, because I was supposed to be training them, stepping in for one of my staff. And I'm like, wow, we went from a journey of there's heavily resistant people of hypercare, and there still is sometimes, to this physician going around teaching all his colleagues and be like, I can teach you how to do this and that. And I'm like, my job is done here. I'm just watching this unfold, and it's actually one of my proudest moments. I'm like, this is amazing. Because I always talk about it is ideally you build a product that you don't need support articles so people understand how to use it. It's mm-hmm. it's intuitive enough. And it was great to kind of see that unfold. So certainly those are kind of very proud moments that kind of make me very excited. Certainly I'm also very excited because we've been growing very fast. It took it was 3 years in the beginning of zero revenue. And then we start growing extremely fast, especially in healthcare. So it's certainly very, very exciting to kind of see that. We work with 20% of hospitals in Ontario already.
Wow.
And I would like to get to 50% in the next 3 years. And those are kind of things I never imagined when we first started. I don't know, just it's really cool to see the impact that we're making. Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Congrats. And one of the other things too that I found interesting is in reading one of your LinkedIn posts recently was around the importance of brainstorming in person.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit more about that and kind of where you came to that insight and how that's applied today for your team at Hypercare?
Yeah, I think working remotely, and I work mostly remotely too, there's a lot of productivity gains when you're individual contributor. You're just trying to do something, answer emails, do certain decks. But I think when you're trying to collaborate in a team environment, sometimes really complicated if it's there's a lot of moving pieces, and trying to think about how to execute a project, at least kind of even figure out the task related to it, who's going to own those tasks. I find in in-person environment, it's just much easier. You have a whiteboard, you can draw things out, but also especially the people who are not as vocal, but they're extremely smart, they're able to vocalize. In a Zoom meeting, unfortunately, still not at the place where, or even in Google Meets, where if someone's talking, usually everyone's just not talking. And mm-hmm. you can't hear side conversations. You can't have side conversation unless you create rooms and everything. So it's very structured. So it's not a brainstorming thing that can happen. But obviously in person, you can read people's facial languages. People who are not as vocal can kind of talk about it. People also less distracted. If they're distracted, you can clearly see they're on a phone, versus mm-hmm. on Zoom, people can have their cameras off. They could be on phone. And someone you really want their knowledge or advice on might not be focused at all. So I think, and I'm also guilty of that, I'm multitasking on Zoom sometimes. So I would say those are kind of things that we really, really appreciated and learned that how important it is in person. When recently we're at a hospital, and one of the biggest challenges around our technology sometimes is that if they're trying to use hypercare in a big way, everyone's using hypercare in the hospital, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, all this stuff, and we're completely replacing pagers. there's a lot of policy that I might have to create. Like, what is appropriate response time when someone sends you a message on hypercare? What if it's a general message? What if it's an urgent message? What if it's a stat message? What are other technologies that people can use to communicate? What are the ones that don't use because hypercare can now actually fulfill that duty? That navigation is quite hard. Mm-hmm. And the hospital is trying to create a policy around that so people know exactly how to navigate the expected use of hypercare. And oftentimes that can be very, very difficult and can take a long time. But because we were in person with them, it was amazing. Like, there was a lot of people, like, you know, different stakeholders in the hospital giving different opinions, and they kept looking to us for guidance. And I also appreciate this hospital when we provide guidance, they were really like learning from what we thought would be best. And they don't always learn and like take what we say, but it was great to kind of see that collaborative environment. And that policy ultimately was created really, really quickly. And it's one of the most sophisticated policies I've ever seen our customers create. So, and I feel like a part of that was accomplished really quickly because it was in person.
In person, yeah. Wow.
So
yeah, hard to replicate that, right? The fidelity of being in person, you can't beat it, right?
No, but it's like extremely hard because like even at the company, like, you know, we have staff now everywhere, even in Canada and staff outside of Canada. And how do you make sure that people outside of Canada or people outside of Ontario is still collaborating in a good environment? And it's a hard time. It's hard for companies to figure out because you don't want to ask people to come in person. And even myself, I'm so used to like working remotely. I lose commute time. But on the other hand, you also recognize that like brainstorming is just so much better like in person. Yeah. So it's hard. Maybe offsite. Yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah, most of the hypercare team is in the Greater Toronto Area, or are they quite distributed?
It's quite distributed. We have quite a number of staff in the GTA. So it's like probably one third in the GTA, one third in like near like Windsor region, and then one third outside of Canada or outside of Ontario. Let's just say outside of Ontario. Like we have staff like in Quebec, and we just have a staff in like Vancouver that just joined us. So it's quite distributed. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And then one of my final questions is around advice, right? Any advice you would give to your younger self, or if there was a, you know, final year student studying in university, trying to figure out what they should do, whether they should join a big corporate tech company or go for a high growth startup. Obviously, it always depends, but what type of guiding principles would you suggest they think about to optimize that decision for themselves?
Yeah, of course. I think if I went back in time and gave myself advice, would be optimized for learning. So I don't think there's any right or wrong answer, like working at a big tech company, working at a startup, working at a mid-stage company. There's always pros and cons. I think it's more of like the opportunity that presents itself. Are you learning a lot? And especially early on in a career, it's like, yeah, I could be paid another 10, 20K more, but fundamentally, if you learn a lot early on in career, you can always capture that value later, right? Mm-hmm. Like, like for example, if someone started a startup and they always ask me like, hey, should I start a startup? Should I work at big tech? If you work at a startup and you work for a year on your own startup and it doesn't work out and you put the energy and you learned a lot, you can always be very employable. But if you do a startup and half the time you're just chilling, going to conferences, I don't know. Startup might not be the right thing because you might not actually learn that much. So with every opportunity they should be focused on is like, how much am I learning? Is it learning in the area that I'm excited about? Is it maybe even for me to learn about what I'm actually excited about? Maybe just beginning phase of my university, I do a lot of different classes. I do a lot of different roles and responsibilities. So I know exactly what I want to build my career in for now, immediate future. So I think just not being afraid of like learning and optimizing for learning. I think also going back, if I went back in time, is like sales is so important. I think like people have this sense of like sales is slimy, whatever. But as anyone who's progressing in a career, you are constantly selling. Like if you're trying to move up as a manager, you're selling to your manager why you should be promoted, right? If you're trying to build a company, you're trying to sell to employees why you should join this company and take a pay cut and take a risk on this company that's unproven. So I think if I went back in time, I would be like, sales is so, so important. Like every possibility, I should learn how to sell. Especially engineers. Like engineers sales in a bad way, but if you want to get to a leadership position at all in engineering, you have to learn how to sell. at all. And that's why those two big things I would probably do. Yeah.
Great advice. Or even when you're a kid, right? Selling your parents of like, hey,
yeah,
I want to be a doctor. Here's why you should support me in my endeavor to be a programmer.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I wouldn't lose that many years to like kind of navigating that. But like, yeah, exactly. Like learning how to sell even to your parents, like, you know, you can definitely practice. Like, why should I get this gift? Or why should I go to this career or whatever? Okay. Selling is constantly something that I would optimize for experience.
Yeah. All the time. or marital advice as well, right? Like it's about compromise, negotiation. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
that is a big one. Like compromising is one that over time I've kind of realized too. It's like sometimes you have to meet people where they're at. And they might get to the vision that you're trying to get to, but if you kind of force it too fast, you scare them. Like that's a good learning from Microsoft too. It's like, you know, I'm at this prospect has 30 pages. They're expecting a paragraph. Can we compromise? How about we do a one page prospect? And if they actually want to know more detail, here's a full page prospect. These are kind of things that I've learned over time because you can't force people to just be like you. No one's exactly like you. Yeah. Totally.
Awesome. Thanks, Albert. This is a fun chat. So for folks who want to follow more about Hypercare, where is the best place for them to find you?
Oh, yeah. You can follow me on LinkedIn, and you can also search up Hypercare on LinkedIn to follow that, too. We make a decent amount of posts around our company and our progress. But yeah, and if there's any, you know, clinicians looking to improve how healthcare gets delivered in their organization, whether it's acute, whether it's a family practice, whether it's a nursing home, we are in different care settings already, and we'd be happy to support you guys in that journey.
Awesome. Thanks, Albert. And I will end with, I think, the best hashtag I've seen lately, which is AxaFax.
Yes, AxaFax.
Or AxaPager, right?
AxaFax, AxaPager. Actually, my license plate for my car is no pagers. So,
no pagers.
yeah, so 100%. No more legacy technology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thanks, Albert. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for your time too, man. Thanks so much, dude.
Yeah, take care.
Take care. See ya.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Asian Tech Leaders. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with your family and friends, leave me a review on iTunes, or drop me a note on our website, asiantechleaders.com. I really appreciate having each of you as a listener and sharing your valuable time with me. Be well. Stay healthy and follow your heart. See you soon.